It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, President Trump signed a religious liberty executive order today. We'll find out what that means for churches that want to be more politically active.
President Trump signed an executive order today that would allow churches and other religious organizations to become more politically active. The order accomplishes that by directing the IRS to use its discretion in enforcing the Johnson Amendment.
The Johnson Amendment prevents churches and tax-exempt religious organizations from certain political activity, like endorsing or opposing political candidates. President Trump said in his signing ceremony today that religious leaders shouldn't have to risk losing their tax-exempt status for speaking about political issues. Here's a listen.
In America, we do not fear people speaking freely from the pulpit. We embrace it. America has a rich tradition of social change beginning in our pews and our pulpits. Perhaps there is no greater example than the historic role of the African American church as the agent for social progress, spurring our nation to greater justice and equality. We must never infringe on the noble tradition of change from the church and progress from the pew.
Howard Schwaber joins us now. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how much do you see this executive order changing things, especially for religious groups that want to be more politically active?
Oh, potentially quite a lot. So the president doesn't have the power to change the law. What he's doing explicitly is instructing the IRS not to enforce these particular laws. It's very much the same move that President Obama made with respect to immigration laws when he instructed the INS not to prioritize the deportation of certain categories of illegal aliens. The result is that, assuming the IRS follows this direction, which I assume that they will, and assuming churches pick up on this news, which I'm sure that they will, I would certainly expect to see an enormous upswing in overt political organizing and political activity, particularly among evangelical and conservative churches, in the near future. There's another wrinkle to this, though, which I haven't heard talked about yet, which is it's important to remember that our Supreme Court has ruled that uses and expenditures of money count as speech. So if the IRS is not going to be enforcing the rules against churches engaging in political advocacy and speech, does that also mean that there will be non-enforcement of the rules about churches acting as conduits for dark money into elections? And there's the potential here for churches to become really major centers of dark money funding.
Could you play that out a little, Howard? How would that happen if churches were to take on that role? And I think you're equating there the money with speech.
Right. Well, I'm speculating a bit, obviously, but in a variety of cases, most recently Citizens United, that's the most famous one, right? The United States Supreme Court has said that spending money is for political purposes is speech. And in the same way that we protect the freedom to express oneself politically, we protect the freedom to spend money politically, both for individuals, for corporations, and so on. Well, we just heard the president explaining that what he's concerned with is to ensure that churches are free to engage in political advocacy. If you put those two things together, that means churches are free to engage in political spending of money. And they can act as centers for the spending of money by their parishioners or by anybody else who wants to coordinate with them. So potentially, and I emphasize, I'm speculating a little bit, but there's a pretty clear potential here for an active regime of non-enforcement to have the effect of opening up churches and religious institutions as channels for political contributions.
Is this something that churches have been clamoring for a long time, or is this something that is coming more from the idea of keeping a campaign promise?
A little bit of both. A lot of churches actually don't like this idea. In fact, 1,300 clergy members signed an open letter on Slate objecting to this proposal. There's a lot of religious leaders who are pleased to see politics kept out of their business. But certainly there are churches, particularly evangelical churches, that have been eager to be allowed to play a more active role in political advocacy on issues like same-sex marriage, for example. It's important to point out that it's almost never the case that a church loses its tax-exempt status. I think it's actually only happened once. So it's not as though there's been this reign of terror in which churches are being denied tax-exempt status right and left. But it is the case that churches may have refrained from engaging in political activity they otherwise would have undertaken, and now that they will feel emboldened to do that. And for the moment, that's mostly the pressure for that freedom is mostly coming from evangelical churches on the right end of the political spectrum.
And the change is, in fact, it sounds like that from the pulpit you could hear an endorsement now perhaps of a candidate, whereas in the past you could have heard about issues and politics in general. How big a change is that shift to the endorsement of a candidate?
In many cases it's not, because we've actually seen those endorsements take place repeatedly, despite the fact that theoretically that should have cost those churches their tax-exempt status. As I say, these rules have never been enforced with any kind of seriousness. But I would expect to see the practice become more widespread. And in fact, one of the things you might expect to see is more and more congregations dividing themselves politically. So there'll be a liberal church and a conservative church, you know, and a liberal synagogue and a conservative synagogue in a given town. If those communities start becoming overtly involved in partisan politics, this could become quite divisive.
And why do you think President Trump focused on the Johnson Amendment in particular in looking at these issues?
Well, it's sort of the one tool that he has. He can't overrule the First Amendment. He can't change the tax laws or any laws for that matter. All he can do is focus on executive agencies that enforce them. And the IRS is an executive agency over which he has direct control. And so he can, you know, issue this order without fear of significant resistance or backlash. It would be much more difficult, for example, to try and order the Department of Justice not to enforce anti-discrimination laws. You know? And the president has no authority to interfere with the enforcement of state-level anti-discrimination laws or restrictions on funding.
We're talking with Howard Schwaber right now, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, looking at the religious liberty executive order that President Trump signed today.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of the president's order here, relaxing enforcement of this Johnson Amendment, opening things up for more explicit political activity in religious organizations? Good idea, bad idea? Do you want to see this happen at your church? Would you like to see your religious organization, your religious leader, actively endorsing a candidate for office, for example? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation with Howard Schwaber. He's a professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, and we're looking at the religious liberty executive order that President Trump signed today that would relax enforcement of the Johnson Amendment, which prevents some churches from endorsing political candidates.
Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think religious leaders, organizations, churches, synagogues, mosques, other congregations should be able to express political views to endorse candidates, specifically to donate as a religious organization on behalf of a candidate or run ads for them, for that matter? Would you like to see this where you worship? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got John joining us in Janesville. John, hi.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
That's good. I'm completely against that. I don't think that religion has anything to do with politics, nor should it. And keeping their money out of it, too. I don't think that that's right. They've got so much money, they can pretty much change any election that way.
John, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. And Howard, John making the point, he thinks that there should be a firewall between politics and religion, which kind of gets at the Johnson Amendment. Could you talk a little bit about what was behind it initially?
Sure. So the idea of a real firewall between politics and religion kind of breaks down in at least one sense, since for a lot of people, their religious principles have a role in dictating their politics. And you can think about that in terms of an issue like abortion, or an issue of like going to war, or of aid to the poor, or of civil rights. You know, in all of those cases, many people form political views based in part on their religious convictions. And so it would be, you know, false to say that people's religion doesn't influence their politics. The idea of the Johnson Amendment and the idea of the kind of firewall metaphor that we usually use, is to try and prevent institutionalized religion or churches or church organizations from playing a role in politics. And the idea there is that you don't want mixtures of those two authorities. You don't want politicians to be appealing for support on a religious basis, so you have the Catholic candidate, for example, in a given race. And conversely, you know, you don't want churches or religious institutions to be identifying themselves on a political basis. If you're a good Republican, you should attend X Baptist church rather than Y Baptist church, you know, that sort of thing. There is an element in some of these laws, like the Johnson Amendment, that goes back to a certain fear of the Catholic Church in particular, an issue that goes all the way back to the late 19th century. So a lot of states have things called Blaine Amendments that limit the use of state funds going to churches. And initially, some of these things were based on the fear that the Catholic Church, which is an organized church, right, in which all the churches in the nation answer to a single authority, from Pope to cardinals to archbishops and bishops and so on, if it were able to participate in politics or compete for government money, would become extremely powerful. And John kind of alluded to that a moment ago when he mentioned this idea that churches have so much money they could buy an election. I don't think that's true in the modern era. I think business corporations have much more money than churches, really. But that fear of domination by religious institutions is certainly one of the elements that was at the heart of this law.
Let's take another quick call now. We've got Ed on the line in Milwaukee. Ed, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these churches want tax-exempt status, but they are political groups on a lot of levels. Hospitals get tax-exempt, and their CEOs make billions of dollars, or millions of dollars. Just get rid of it. Let them have a free-for-all.
And thank you for the call, and do you think Ed is onto something there, Howard, in the sense that this could make things more transparent for worshipers and for politics watchers and those who are watching political contributions and influence?
Well, actually, I think I heard Ed making a different point, which was questioning the idea of tax-exempt status at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a very, very good point there. There's no question that... So the original idea of tax-exempt status was to allow charitable institutions to do their good work in an effective way. But, I mean, he might have mentioned universities, for example. There are private universities, the Harvards and Yales of the world, that are extremely wealthy, tax-exempt institutions. And it's not at all clear by what logic they should retain that status. So the idea of doing away with tax-exempt status as a whole is really, in many ways, quite an attractive one. The problem, of course, is that there are very powerful political constituencies, like hospitals and universities and churches, that have grown up around, you know, with a desire to preserve these tax-exempt statuses, and so it's politically hard to do. But I must say I have a lot of sympathy for Ed's position.
And we leave it there. We're out of time. Howard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison, and he joined us to talk about President Trump's new executive order on religious organizations and political campaigning.
Coming up after the news, we'll celebrate the 20th anniversary of the storytelling phenomenon, The Moth.
And remember, it is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. You can pitch in, make a pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio, and make a difference along the way at WPR.org or by calling 888-202-2552.
Support these great conversations. We count on you to help pay for it. Make that donation, that contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. 2017 marks the 20th anniversary of The Moth. You might recognize that music from The Moth Radio Hour. This year marks the 20th anniversary of The Moth, the project that helped revive the art of storytelling. What started as a small gathering of friends telling stories on a porch has now turned into something bigger than they could have imagined.
In those 20 years, Moth storytellers have told tens of thousands of stories on stages all over the world, and there's a good chance you're familiar with their podcast as well as their public radio show, The Moth Radio Hour, which you can catch every Thursday night at 7 p.m. here on the Ideas Network.
Catherine Burns joins us now. She's the artistic director for The Moth and the editor of a new compilation of Moth stories called The Moth Presents all these wonders, true stories about facing the unknown. Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, 20 years of the moth, and this thing is big, Catherine. What is it about the moth that really just caught people's ears over the last two decades?
I think people were looking for the opportunity to connect one-on-one with people. You know, we live in this world that's, you know, very digital. You know, we talk about it a lot, right, that we connect to each other through our devices, through the internet. And, you know, the moth and really the whole modern storytelling movement that we've seen over the last 20 years, because there are thousands of wonderful storytelling shows, you know, not just the moth, that have grown up around the world, it rose up hand to hand with the rise of the internet. And I don't think that's such a surprise that even as we were, had all these modern conveniences, that there was this deep desire to walk into a room and hear the story directly from that person, you know, and to connect. So I think it was the biggest appeal.
We were ready to hear stories. Were we ready to tell them? Did people remember, in a way, how to get up in front of people and tell a compelling story?
Well, I think, you know, I think that we all have our own wonderful stories, you know, that we tell. And, you know, people have been telling stories around the campfire and around restaurants and at kitchen tables for years and years. So maybe it wasn't such a stretch to take those stories, those bar stories or kitchen table stories, and put them on stage in front of a live audience. When the moth works best, every single person in the room feels like that person is talking just to them. So even when we do a big, you know, 1,500-seat venue, the idea is to create that intimacy that you would have if you were just sitting around at dinner.
And now anyone who's listened to The Moth knows that you do themes on episodes, and the book is no different. It's got sub-themes, but the big overarching thing in the subtitle, Stories About Facing the Unknown. Why did you choose that for the book?
Well, it was interesting. So Matthew Inman, who's our editor at Crown, he and I read 400 or 500 stories to try to choose the 45 that are in the book. And one of the things that we just kept noticing, like the through lines, was stories where something happens to somebody that maybe they weren't expecting, or they take a big risk and it pays off, or they're, you know, forced to do something they maybe thought they didn't want to do because of the circumstances of their life, and, you know, the resilience they find in getting through it, that they often end up in a different place and maybe an unexpected place. And we're like, well, that's inherently interesting. And so we chased that.
And what was it like taking this medium, you know, the moth, it's true stories told live, and trying to make sure that these were compelling stories that worked in print?
Well, yeah, at first we were very skeptical about doing a book. That's the truth. And I think what made us want to do it was when the idea was presented that we could transcribe the stories that had been told and then lightly edit them for the page with the goal of making the stories as you read them be stories that you feel like you can hear the voice, that they come alive on the page, as opposed to just taking the idea of the story and completely rewriting it in essay form, if that makes sense. So, over the years, we've had a radio show since 2009, and we would transcribe the stories while working on the radio show. And we noticed that some of them really worked beautifully on the page. And I think that was also one of the things that made us want to do it. Like, we would find that some of them we really enjoyed reading over and over when we were looking for a quote or, you know, maybe trying to do little edits. And that also, we're like, it's so fun, you know, when you're reading a story that you're literally holding the stories in your hand. And there was a new intimacy to that, and we wanted to share that with our community.
We're talking to Catherine Burns, Artistic Director for The Moth, editor of The Moth Presents All These Wonders, True Stories About Facing the Unknown. I want to give a listen to a clip or two from stories that appear in the book. Let's start with Chendere Kumanyika, 2013 story, a hip-hop artist. Here's a little listen to that story.
I have no idea how to use Microsoft Excel. I lied about my skills to get this job. And my solution to the first two problems has been, when in doubt, hit enter. What I'm trying to explain to you is, on December 21st, 2007, at 2:15 p.m., my life sucked. And it didn't just suck because I had a job that I was no good at and that few people wanted. It sucked because only 2 years ago, I had a job that I was very good at and that everyone wanted.
So just a small portion of a story there. It is one that it kind of sucks you in. Is that the hallmark of a good story?
I think so. I mean, I think what's fun about his story is, you know, he starts out in a very relatable place. He's this temp who doesn't know how to use Excel. And, I mean, probably most of us have been there on some level or another, like in some entry-level job that we don't even want, that we're actually failing at. But then the fun reveal is that, you know, just a year before, he was this huge hip-hop star. You know, I think in the end, I think maybe sort of a one-hit wonder, if you will. But he had been at the top of his game flying around in private planes, and so it's him trying to figure out what to do with a contrast and how to take himself to the next place. And I mean, there's someone who had to face the unknown against his will.
And here's another listen, comedian Tig Notaro now talking about her stepfather, Rick. This is during a 2012 Moth event.
He's very stoic, removed, emotionless. And I used to joke and say that he was kind of like C-3PO, but with less emotion. And then it dawned on me recently that that joke actually doesn't make any sense. Because C-3PO is very emotional. Just like, Atu, where are you?
And ultimately, this story, Matt, is both funny at times and very sad at times. Later, Tig talks about the death for her mother. How difficult it is for storytellers to balance extremes in stories like that.
I think the best storytellers do. I mean, people sometimes say, you know, what you like better are sad stories or funny stories. But I think that most of my favorite stories have a little bit of both, right? That, you know, you can be talking about a serious event, like in this case, the death of her mom, but there's still usually some humor to be found in that situation that's not humor that you're using to try to deflect from the emotion, but humor that's just real and organic. Like, I remember at my own mother's funeral, we were pulling up to the funeral parlor, and my nephew made a really funny joke at just the right moment, and we'd been so sad, crying our eyes out for days, and all of a sudden, me and my three sisters cracked up so hard. So as the limousine driver opened the door, we were falling out of the limousine laughing, and we were all horrified, but at the same time, I think my mother would have loved it, because that's real life.
Now, looking at these stories, they're not just interesting anecdotes. They're not just a fun story. Whenever I've heard or seen The Moth, the good stories are ones that really inform who the person is now. And I think, I don't know what that story would be for me. How, when you're working with people in The Moth, how do you help them find and distill those stories?
Well, one of the things I would ask you if I were working with you on a story is I would say, what are the stories that you tend to look forward to telling to a new friend? Or, you know, if you first met your spouse, like, what were some of the stories you couldn't wait to tell them? Or what are the stories that your friends ask you to tell to mutual friends? Because sometimes those are anecdotal, but I usually find that in that anecdote, there's some truth about you that if you talk it through, it will be revealed. Because like, there's a reason that we tell these same stories about ourselves over and over.
I want to talk some about the future of The Moth, Catherine. You've got now this book, you've got the live events, including a couple in Wisconsin now, the radio show, the podcast. Have you reached peak Moth yet, or are there still more things to come?
Well, I hope we haven't. You know, I mean, our goal is always just to get these beautiful stories to as many people as possible. One of the things we love about the book is it's just a whole new medium for people to explore the stories in. And we think that the world, you know, we live in a world right now where I think people feel like we're a little bit divided. And when you read these individual stories, you find again and again that we always have more in common, I believe, than what we have in common is much greater than what separates us. And so with that goal in mind, you know, we just want Moth stories everywhere. We love our storytellers so much, and we feel like the whole world needs to hear what they have to say.
And can you give some encouragement? There are people who live in communities where The Moth isn't, but what would you say to them to try to get them to embrace storytelling, even just on an informal level?
I mean, ask your neighbors questions. You know, maybe instead of watching a TV show or going to the movies, sit down and talk to your neighbors of the day. Sit down with your family. Ask your grandfather for stories of his childhood. You know, my dad isn't much of a he doesn't fancy himself to be much of a storyteller, but even him, if I sit there and kind of pry and ask a million questions, I'll get him talking, which can be a beautiful thing. If people want to tell stories on the Moth stage, even if they live far away, we have a pitch line where they can call and leave a two-minute version of a story, and many of the stories that have been in our past two books and that are on the radio come from people who we've met when they just called our pitch line.
I got to ask, as we start to wrap up, does working so closely with The Moth change the way you see people, not just the person at the counter, you know, the senior citizen on the bench or whatever, but knowing that when you look at them, there's a story there?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. My mama used to always say, you know, you have to be nice to the person standing in line at the grocery store because you never know what's been going on with them. I'm from Alabama, so she said that with a southern accent. And I think that there's great truth in that, and that if you walk around with that feeling that everyone has a story, I think it's much easier to treat strangers with compassion, and God knows the world could use more of that these days.
We'll leave it there. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. We love you guys, so thanks for having me on.
That was Catherine Burns, artistic director for The Moth, editor of a new compilation of Moth stories. It's called The Moth Presents All These Wonders, True Stories About Facing the Unknown. You can hear The Moth Radio Hour here on Wisconsin Public Radio every Thursday. Hey, that's today at 7 o'clock.